Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's call. AILA experts report live from Port Courts. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. Please note this call may be recorded. I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn today's conference over to Greg Chen, Director of Government Relations for American Immigration Lawyers Association. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Greg Chen. Welcome to our press conference today regarding the trip that Laura Lynch and Lady Perez Davis of the American Immigration Lawyers Association has done in the past week to the border region, Laredo, Texas, Brownsville, Texas, and San Antonio, to look at the opening of courts along the border region to handle particular cases of those individuals that are being forced to wait in Mexico under the Remain in Mexico policy and are required to then cross the border on a single day to appear in court. Lady and Laura are still in Brownsville today, having spent the week trying to observe exactly what is happening in these new port courts. One of the main concerns that we have is that there is tremendous secrecy because DHS has given very little information to the public and is denying access to attorneys and reporters who would like to be able to see how these operations are going. If you have not already looked at it, review their blog on AILA's Think Immigration blog. It's at AILA.org. I'm sorry, it's at www.thinkimmigration.org is the website for that. The title of their blog pretty much sums up exactly the themes that you'll be hearing about, namely, the title is Searching for Fairness and Transparency, a First-Hand Look at the Port Courts in Laredo and Brownsville. And essentially, if there's any takeaway here today, our concern at the American Immigration Lawyers Association is that these courts are undermining due process and the real protection that these families and individuals need when they are seeking relief before the court. And the court procedures are now functionally sham courts because of the lack of real protections and due process that Americans expect in courts. Before I turn it over to Laura and Lady, let me just do a couple of housekeeping details. First of all, we're going to make sure to give priority for news reporters to ask your questions first, partly because this is a telepress conference, and also because we know at 2:30 there is a press conference that DHS Secretary McAleen is going to be holding, so we want to make sure you get to ask your questions quickly. And once this call is over, we'll give that Q&A opportunity time. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over first to Laura Lynch, who is a senior policy counsel with the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And Laura's focus has been on immigration court policy, and so she's going to go first. Laura?
Thanks so much, Greg. Yeah, so since the January implementation of the Migration Protection Protocols, otherwise known as the Remain in Mexico program, the administration has returned over 42,000 migrants to Mexico. So migrants are forced to wait for their day in U.S. immigration court, Nuevo Laredo and Matamoros, two of the most dangerous cities in the world. It's clear to me after sitting all day in court, listening to case after case of unrepresented migrants, that there's just an overwhelming inability for these individuals to obtain safe passage in order to attend their hearings at these port courts. Asylum seekers and migrant families told immigration judges in court this week they've become targets of cartel violence, kidnapping, assault, and extortion while they're waiting for their hearings in the U.S. immigration court. For those of that do make it back to the U.S. To have their cases heard, they're now finding themselves in these secretive tent facilities in Laredo and Brownsville, Texas. These facilities, they're functioning as virtual immigration courts. The judges are actually sitting at brick-and-mortar immigration court locations, and there's a video feed being sent directly into these tent facilities where the migrants are telling their story to the judge. The rollout of these port courts has been shrouded in secrecy. DHS did not provide advanced public information to attorneys or other stakeholders about even just the most basic operational logistics related to the new tent courts. The tent court in Laredo was actually launched on September 11th, and in Brownsville, the first hearing took place on September 12th. At that point, my colleague, Lady, and I, we traveled to Texas to really just try and learn more information, to learn about the policies and procedures of these new tent courts to share with immigration attorneys so that they could best represent their clients. On Monday and Tuesday of this week, we actually attempted to visit the Laredo tent courts. We were turned away after asking to observe the proceedings of these tent courts as attorney observers. At the Laredo tent courts, they're actually the judges are sitting at the San Antonio brick-and-mortar courts, and we were told that we could observe hearings there. On Wednesday, we did observe the hearings at the San Antonio Immigration Court. And then on Thursday, we went to Brownsville, and we attempted access to the Brownsville Tent Court, at which time we were turned away by DHS. And we were again told we could observe hearings at the brick-and-mortar courts for Brownsville, which are Harlingen and Port Isabel. These port courts raise grave concerns about transparency, due process, and access to legal representation. After really trying to obtain access to these courts and seeing the locations of these courts, it's clear to us that the administration intentionally built these so-called courts at the CBP port of entry in order to maintain operational control and limit public access to these facilities. Unlike other immigration courts, the tents built in Laredo and Brownsville, they're not open to the public. Media and advocates have been banned from observing the hearings at the port by CBP. The so-called courts are effectively run by ICE and CBP personnel, along with contractors. From what we can tell, there's limited, if any, to EIR immigration court personnel on site. Each time we attempted to gain access to these tent facilities, we were told by ICE officials either it was ICE not allowing us to observe these hearings at the tent facilities, or ICE pointed the finger at CBP. DOJ cannot abdicate its requirement to provide public access to the court simply because the location of the court is on CBP property. These makeshift tent facilities are courts run by DHS prosecutors. It's clear that the judges have limited understanding of how these court proceedings are supposed to work and limited control of the overall process. The only individuals that are actually permitted into the tent facility are attorneys with attorney-client representation agreements already on file. And sometimes their pro bono interpreters and or legal staff have been permitted in. My colleague, Lady Perez Davis, is going to speak about the barriers that many of these attorneys face in attempting to represent their clients in these tent court facilities.
Thank you, Laura. Good afternoon, everyone. So as Laura mentioned, as we have gone through, attempted to enter both of the tent court facilities as well as seen the cases at the San Antonio court, we've really come across themes that we'd like to kind of bring light to and shine attention to. And one of the most important ones, in our opinion, is that migrants do not have meaningful access to counsel, not only under the MPP program, but especially with the implementation of these port courts. So, for instance, we've spoken to several attorneys that are on the ground in both Laredo and Brownsville, and they told us that they do not feel safe traveling to the Mexican Mexican side of the border to Nuevo Laredo or to Matamoros to meet with their clients. So really the only time that they will have to meet with the clients is the time that's provided by DHS. And so this essentially means that DHS, which has full control, as Laura mentioned, of these 10 courts, has complete control over attorney-client representation when the migrants are on the U.S. side of the border. So, for instance, at the Laredo court, the few attorneys that were there to represent some of the migrants under this program, they were supposed to get an hour of attorney-client time prior to the hearing, but it took so long for them to get through the several layers of security that they only really got 20 minutes before the hearing. At the Brownsville 10 court, we spoke with some of our members or with one of our members that represented an individual, and she said that at the Brownsville facility, she was not allowed, literally not permitted to speak to her client after the court. And so it's important to note that there are things that the attorney has to not only sign with the client, but information about what just happened at the hearing, what the next steps are at the hearing. And it's so critical for the attorneys to get attorney-client time with the individual, because these are people that are marooned in Mexico. And so another one of the issues that we saw with meaningful or lack of meaningful access to counsel was the issue of the attorney-client agreement that Laura alluded to a little earlier ago. So this agreement has to already be on file with the Department of Justice, but this agreement does not allow for attorneys to put an international address. So the attorneys are having to physically mail or take the actual E-28, which is what the form is called, this agreement, into the brick and mortar court with addresses of their clients that are abroad in Mexico. And so when really this will become a bigger issue when immigration judges from all over the country are detailed in to take these cases, because of the confusion that will create of where you're supposed to file your attorney client agreement, where you're supposed to file the evidence to actually physically represent a client. And so it's really important that we note just how difficult it is for the few attorneys that are in the area to represent these people, and how difficult it's been for the people marooned in Mexico to gain access, meaningful access to counsel. One of the other things that we heard as we've been talking to folks on the ground is that migrants don't have access to any information. They're traditionally at detained for migrants who are detained in the interior of the country, sometimes they're able to get Know Your Rights presentations or legal orientations that, even if they don't have an attorney, those orientations can guide them through the process of understanding what exactly it is that is happening at the immigration court when they go for their hearings. And so what we're seeing with the MPP cases at these court courts is that individuals who do not have access to attorneys, don't have access to this critical information, are being forced to argue their claims for asylum against trained lawyers, right? Because the government never goes unrepresented. So these migrants don't have access to basic necessities on many occasions at the shelters that they're in Mexico, much less do they have access to interpretation services, printers or copiers to make their claims legally sufficient to present to the court. You know, one of the most salient examples of this week that has kind of remained with me was of a young girl, maybe 18, 19 years old. We were observing the docket in San Antonio, and the IJ, the immigration judge, asked the young girl whether she wanted to apply for asylum. And she responded that she did not. And so as the IJ was confused, as all of us that were watching were kind of confused as well, the IJ said, well, how do you want to proceed? And she said, Your Honor, I would like to apply for refuge, you know, not understanding that asylum would be the legal avenue for applying for that refuge. And so this basic misunderstanding that she had, and that we saw kind of across the docket of even what type of protection they're seeking, is an issue that we saw over and over and over again. And Know Your Rights presentations, legal orientations, like those that are done in detained settings, would have lasting effects on these people's ability to understand the case that's being presented against them. And lastly, and I'll let you all ask questions now. I don't want to take up too much time, but I really did want to bring light to how intentionally designed these 10 facilities are to curtail the due process of migrants and asylum seekers at the southern border. So as I mentioned, access to counsel is nearly impossible. Attorney access to their clients has been made difficult and convoluted. Individuals are being forced to argue their own claims in immigration court before an immigration judge. And migrants are given documents in a language they don't understand. There's no translated version for them to have a chance to understand. And so, you know, as we're thinking through, you know, the due process that's required by our Constitution, right? Due process requires two things. It requires the migrant to have notice, and it requires the migrant to have the opportunity to be heard. And what we saw this week were notices to appear that had incorrect names, they had incorrect countries of origin, no valid addresses. We saw individuals with no real understanding of the case that was being presented against them. And so with the rollout of the Remain in Mexico program and the extension of it through these port courts, the government has basically guaranteed that there's been a complete erosion of due process at the southern border for people applying for protection at the southern border. And so really, one of the things that I want to leave you with is that what we saw were asylum seekers that were confused, they were exhausted, they were desperate. They pled with the immigration judges not to be returned to Mexico. They asked for refuge and protection, yet they were still sent back after pro forma, what they call non-refoulement interviews. So we must continue to push oversight on these 10 courts because, as Laura mentioned and Greg alluded to, we just have not received information to this day, even though they opened on September 11th and the 12th. And as these cases are ramped up at these port courts, we must continue to ask questions of DHS, of DOJ, and urge members of Congress to hold them accountable and protect the due process of these individuals.
Thank you so much, Lady. Everyone, that was Lady Perez Davis, Policy Counsel at the American Immigration Lawyer Association. Lady, as you can tell, has a tremendous expertise and focuses on border processing issues in particular. And given her background as a practicing immigration lawyer with Catholic Charities for 3 years prior to coming to AILA, she brings a lot of insight to that. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it back over to Catherine, the operator, who will give you instructions if you would like to ask a question of either Laura Lynch or Lady Perez Davis, our two speakers for today. Catherine?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touchtone telephone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, that is the star and 1 keys to ask a question today. And our very first question comes from Lauren Villagran with El Paso Times. Please go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering if you've seen Mexican asylum seekers get looped into the MPP net. I know they're not supposed to be, but we're seeing a lot of Mexican asylum seekers up at the El Paso Juarez area, and I'm wondering if any are getting caught in the MPP loop.
So we did not see them personally. Laura and I were kind of on an expedition to actually be able to listen into these cases and got denied at several of the courts. But we were on the ground with Amnesty International and Women's Refugee Commission, and at least one of the groups saw one Mexican national, but it's unclear whether it was a family unit. I mean, there's been a lot of confusion as to whether it was a mistake on the NTA, like I mentioned earlier, for another case that we saw, whether it was actually a Mexican national.
Yeah, and if you feel free to follow up with us, we can try and get more information about that one specific case. I know that some of our colleagues were taking very close notes. I think it was either Monday or Tuesday that case happened.
Great, thank you.
Next question.
Our next question comes from Diane Solis with Dallas Morning News. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for this call. Has there been any past VTC litigation that you'll leverage as you push for our due process in the tent courts?
Thanks, Dan, for that question. VTC, you know, we have seen under this administration just a massive expansion of the use of video teleconferencing in the immigration courts. There are a lot of due process concerns with that expansion, particularly when individuals have to prove their credibility in asylum cases in front of an immigration judge via video teleconferencing. It's very difficult, you know, to convey your story, to convey the most intimate details of harm that you've experienced to a judge via through an interpreter and through a video screen. And so AILA has numerous concerns about the expansion of and use of video teleconferencing, particularly to when immigration judges are adjudicating these cases for such vulnerable populations. I do know that in the last year, there was a video teleconferencing litigation in New York. I do not know the status of where that case sits, but I do believe there are legal organizations that are looking into such potential litigation in the future.
This is Greg Chen. I'll just also mention that one of our practitioner members, Jody Goodwin, who also sits on AILA's Border Task Force and has been meeting with Laura and Lady this past week, she has clients in some of these port courts that have been having appearances this week, and she reported that for one of the hearings, they had delays because the video mechanism was not working properly. And that may just sound like a technical glitch, but it's an indication of how poor this technology is for a means to hold substantive asylum or other kinds of immigration law hearings. And we know that they're going to take it to that point of having full merits hearings for things like asylum in front of the video camera.
Thanks for that, Greg. Actually, that just reminded myself of Lady and our experience on Wednesday. We were sitting in the San Antonio Immigration Court for the 8:30 a.m. MPP hearing, and as soon as the judge tried to start the hearing, within, I guess, 1 to 2 minutes, the entire feed went down, and it was definitely a 10-minute delay. The judge said, well, how do we fix this? Looking over to DHS to try and fix the video screen. But it's clear that, you know, that's not the only technical glitch. There's definitely a delay in the video feed. We were told by attorneys in Laredo that when their client was talking about their fear and harm of returning to Mexico, that the video feed cut out. I believe it was on Monday, from the Laredo Tent Court up into San Antonio. There was also another report of when one of the feeds went down that the judge from a different courtroom videoed in to the wrong courtroom. And so there was a miscommunication in the actual video feeds themselves. So it's definitely been a chaotic rollout, and there are numerous concerns with the use of the video teleconferencing for these situations.
Thank you for that question. Operator, are there other questions queued up?
As a reminder, that is the star and one keys if you would like to ask a question today. We'll pause a moment to allow any further questions to queue.
While we're waiting for questions to queue, I'll just jump in here for a moment. This is Greg Chen again and say that, again, one of the concerns with using video is that it is a specific responsibility of an immigration judge during a hearing to assess the credibility of somebody seeking relief. And there is a substantially developed body of law in asylum law regarding the credibility determinations made by an immigration judge. And I think it would be not only extremely difficult, if not impossible, for an immigration judge to do an accurate credibility determination when they can barely interact with the individual through the video teleconferencing mechanism. That will severely compromise their ability to make accurate, consistent credibility determinations of the person and the witnesses that are being asked to explain their situation to the court. Operator, other questions?
It appears that we have no further questions at this time.
Lady and Laura, I'm going to give you each another opportunity to provide summary comments, if you'd like. Why don't we start in the speaking order that we began? Laura Lynch, any final comments?
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Really, the big takeaway just after spending a week here on the ground is that these port courts are designed to speed up the deportations of individuals with very little regard for due process or the principles of fairness and humanitarianism. It's clear that steps must be taken to halt this administration's interference with judicial independence. It's clear that the immigration judges have very little control over this current process that's being rolled out with the court facilities, and it's time that Congress really investigate the rollout of the tent courts, and it's time that they create an independent Article I court, separate and apart from the Department of Justice.
Yeah, and I will just follow up by saying that after the few days that we've been here, I cannot stress enough the importance of continuing to shine light and asking questions on these facilities. To date, as they've been ramped up, we still don't have answers from the agencies. I mean, even basic things such as where are attorneys supposed to enter the facilities is something that they have not provided answers on. And continuing to hold the agencies accountable for what is occurring at these facilities of what will end up being more than 40,000 people that have been subjected to the Remain in Mexico program. Thank you, guys.
Laura and Lady, thank you for giving us the time this afternoon to join this call, especially as you've been in somewhat of a frenzied pace going from border station to border station. So with that, we will conclude our press conference. Thanks to all the members of the press who were able to join today. If you have further questions for Laura or Lady, please reach out to Belle Woods or Tessa Weissman of the AILA Communications Department. I believe you have their contact information from the press advisory. Thank you very much again for joining, and this concludes our press conference.
Thank you.